Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Let's set the stage. We come into 2023. The consensus is pretty clear. The first half's going to be tough. We've got to pay the bill for the tightening of the last 12 months. Got it? Second half's going to be better. You get a recovery. The year starts, boom, everyone's wrong. The NASDAQ 100's up about 8% year to date. The Stoxx 50, the Euro Stoxx 50 here in Europe is up about 9% year to date. Max Kettner of HSBC said, get on board. Max joins us now. Max, I have to say, once I knew I was coming to London for a week, you were the man I wanted to catch up with. That note from a couple of weeks ago, and I'll share the quote with our audience just in case they missed it. So you're bearish the whole of 22, super underweight, max underweight, then you said this to start 23. Having been staunch bears for much of 22, we think the consensus is wrong. We see a variety of reasons to be less bearish on risk assets in the first half. So let's talk about what you see so far. Do you like what you see so far?
So far, I think yes, but we've got to be honest and also say there has been some easing also on the bond side of things, right? So it's not just been cyclical strength, but it's also been strength on the bond side of things. So that has been taken pretty positively, I would say, by risk assets as well. That's part of the reason also why the NASDAQ was outperforming, why growth and tech stocks were outperforming. Now, I do think if we look at the consensus, right, I do think, look, we've got very pessimistic expectations. I think everyone is saying, look, earnings expectations are still too high. I don't disagree with that, but I disagree with the sequencing. I disagree with the timing, right? Because if we've got pretty much everyone agreeing that H1 is going to be tough, if we've got, you know, economists agreeing like they've never agreed before. Look at the Philadelphia Fed survey, right, on this recession probability. That's on like at the highest in 50 years. So we've got consensus agreeing on the probability of a recession, on the factors driving it, and on the timing. Now, what's the downside surprise then, right? What's the downside surprise to earnings? If you've seen in Q4 and now in Q1, those earnings revisions downwards, particularly in the cyclicals, in consumer discretionary, in materials, in the mega caps, in IT and communication services. So exactly where we want to see them. What's the actual downside surprise? Now, I would argue, look, if we get an average recession, right, it's not going to blow anyone's boat, right? It's not going to be like, oh yeah, this is a massive surprise. You know, this is why we need to get bearish now. No, not at all. Actually, what we need now is we need to get something properly going wrong, right? We need to have an accident. We need to have something break. Then you can be bearish.
You clearly thought it was upside risk. We've got a squeeze right now. That's clear. I'm trying to work out what are the durable tailwinds for this market. I get it. Everything you've said, a lot of people are on board with it. What's durable about what we're seeing?
I think it's still durable because sentiment and positioning is still so downbeat. I mean, let's not forget, we've just updated our sort of aggregate real money investor positioning study on Monday, and that still shows underweight positions on aggregate in equities and in high yield credit. That's normally not the case, right? That's historically been rarely the case that you see outright underweight positions. You see the same thing, right? If you look at CTA equity betas, they're still down. Yes, they've gone up a bit, but they're still on in Neville terms, still down. Look at equity betas of US equity funds, massively underweight. Multi-asset fund betas are sort of average. None of that is telling us, oh yeah, like everyone's already gone bullish. And if anything, when we talked to clients in the last sort of 2-3 weeks, the biggest pushback we got was, well, I know that everyone else is already bullish, therefore I have to continue to be bearish.
Right. Let's break this up, equities versus credit, and start with equities. Microsoft this morning, or rather after the close yesterday, how many messages did you get saying, look at Microsoft, you're wrong? What did you say back?
No, look, I mean, what I would say is it's not the time yet to go full on max overweight equities, right? With that, I agree. But that is mostly very, very tactical, because look at what's priced in for the Fed for the next two meetings. We've got less than 50 basis points priced in into Fed funds now, cumulatively, for the next two meetings. So they've just got to come out next week and say, look, we're going to go 25, but we'll do another 25 in March, right? They're going to guide us towards that. And even that would already be a slightly hawkish surprise, and that would weigh on high multiple tech stocks and so on, right? It would weigh on valuations again. Perhaps a bit of a higher rates vol, but a bit of higher real rates, and that means then weighing on multiples in tech. So very tactically, I don't like equities. Like, you know, I'm not massively, massively bullish on equities just yet. I would say in a muddling through scenario, right, where you say, look, it's going to be neither here or there, right? We're muddling through in terms of growth, slow grind lower rather than really a swoosh down and the recovery in H2. That means that credit, you know, high yield credit is fine, emerging market debt is fine, IG debt is fine, right? All of that, you just churn over the carry. That's fine.
Well, let's talk about emerging markets and let's talk about credit. Emerging markets, I think it was Morgan Stanley Investment Management yesterday, get on board. They're not alone. That's quickly becoming consensus. EM International outperforms. Can we talk about domestic US credit? Triple C's. Citi came out yesterday, and I have to say it was a nuanced report, but the headline is buy triple C's. How much risk do you want to take in credit? Do you want to go right to the bottom of the quality stack and get into high yield, into triple C's?
Yeah, I think that does make sense to an extent, right? If we look at triple B's versus single A's and we compare that against PMIs, there is actually much less weakness priced in. If you look at triple C's versus double B's, that looks, you know, looks much fairer priced relative to where macro indicators are. So there you could actually argue, well, the weakness is priced, particularly if you compare it, right, within high yield. That weakness is pretty much in the price. So that's good, right? It'd be much worrying, I think, if we talk about the macro side of things as well. One of the pushbacks we got is, I remember we had our note down and you know, people said, but look at the ISM, look at the services
it's
ISM, the new orders, it's 45.
Who wants to buy credit
how
with sub 50
turn, you know,
BMIs?
How can you turn more constructive now? My answer is very simple. I wouldn't turn constructive if it was still at 55 or 60, because then now leading indicators would still point down and we'd say, hey, we got another 10, 15 points lower. Be careful. Now you're at 45. I look at him like, well, this is exactly what I wanted to see. Done, right? Let's get on.
Max Kettner, you make it sound simple. It's not. We've got a challenging year ahead of HSBC. Max Kettner there of HSBC.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel Financial Advisors. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
A
Let's frame the last 12 months. This is important. We've been wrestling worldwide with inflation, and central banks have made a move. The ECB's gone to 250. The Bank of England's gone to 350. The Federal Reserve has gone to 450. The Bank of Japan, the BOJ, has done absolutely nothing. Is that going to change this year? Jane Foley of Rabobank, alongside us in the beating heart of foreign exchange. Jane, fantastic to catch up with you. Let's start there. Sub-zero at the BOJ. Is that going to change this year?
You know, it might, but it might not. And I think that's the really crucial point here, because if we saw, you know, the meeting in January, we saw speculators all egging on for a change in yield curve control. And what do they get? Nothing. And I think this is the risk. The market's now assuming that we're going to get a replacement for Kuroda in April, of course, as he steps back. And they're assuming that we're going to get maybe a significant change in policy. We might get a change in policy, but it may not be significant. And that's the point. We might get another tweak to yield curve control. We may get an interest rate hike. We may not, because if you look at the time frame for the Bank of Japan, they're probably not going to be hiking interest rates next year when, for instance, the Fed could be easing and other central banks. So you know you've got a limited time frame. But then you look at the fundamentals. At the fundamentals, yes, inflation is above its target, but only because import prices are not because it's domestically generated, which is the golden goose for the Bank of Japan. And if Kuroda gets replaced, there's a very good chance that he gets replaced maybe by one of his deputies, maybe by somebody else from the Bank of Japan, all of which have been supportive of the very accommodative policies for a long time. So disappointment could be coming.
Well, let's pick up on what you just said. It's the replacement. I think that's what gets everyone's attention, the fact that we have this final meeting with Kuroda in March and then the handoff in April. Which chalice carries the most poison? Does Governor Kuroda hand over a policy already set on a path to move away from yield curve control and towards higher interest rates? Or does he hand over what there is right now? Which chalice carries the most poison?
I think it depends on the outcome of the spring wage rounds, really. And you know, the indicators are that, yes, the spring wage rounds are going to bring some moderate increase in domestically generated inflation, wage inflation, which is what they wanted to see. And, you know, that could lay the framework for a change in yield curve control and another tweak. Will it lay the framework for a change in interest rate policy? Well, you know, that's a little bit further down the line. I don't think we can make that decision yet. But, you know, the Kuroda might be leading the Bank of Japan, but he leads it with a whole board. And that board won't necessarily be changed that much. So I think there is not going to be this massive change towards a very hawkish central bank. You may get a slightly less dovish central bank.
The perspective within the BOJ was that this was perhaps a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reset inflation expectations higher. He's been doing this now for 10 years. I think we all remember when he took this on back in 2013. Does he leave, walk away with any success whatsoever?
I think there is some success. I mean, again, that harps back to the whole Peter Pan issue, the whole psychological issue that he thought that if you bring in an inflation target, people would assume that inflation might be higher and they would alter their spending behaviour accordingly. But as we know, that really has taken a very long time. But, you know, with inflation around the globe, this perhaps has given a little bit of an impetus into inflation. So there is a little bit here. You've got the government of the Bank of Japan behind Kuroda. You've got the Prime Minister saying to firms, yeah, you know, guys, you need to raise wages. And therefore you get what they're looking for, which is this virtuous circle behind higher wages, higher domestic demand, higher profitability, etc. And there are some glimmers of optimism that this might be coming, but I don't think there's a huge amount of confidence that they're there yet, hence the cautious tone.
You've implied there could be some disappointment. Dolly yen's come back from 150, sub 130, about 129 right now. Push that through the FX market for me. Where does that leave dolly yen?
I think we could still see 128 in 3 months. Of course, we are assuming, of course, the dollar is weak, and that's perhaps a large part of that movement back from 150. So, you know, 128 is possible. Like I say, you know, there is the possibility of another movement, another tweak in yield curve control, maybe some indication that they could move away from that in the months ahead. But the problem is, again, is that the window of opportunity is quite short. So 128 is possible, you know, maybe even 126 in the middle of the year. But I don't think we're going to be, you know, falling hugely in dolly yen.
You mentioned the US dollar. I remember Tom, Lisa and I sitting here with you, maybe in September. I think it was back end of September. We were looking at cable at 103.50, strong dollar, euro dollar, 95 something, strong dollar. It's all backed away since then. I think it's been a 10, 11% move on DXY. I'm sitting here this week trying to work out what's durable about all of this, particularly for euro dollar. I know there is a positive surprise. I know that we've got that adjustment as we move away from the risk of recession.
What's durable about these tailwinds that we're seeing start to build?
Well, you know, I think this is really particularly interesting when you come to the euro part of euro dollar, because, you know, the market has now priced in a much better situation than was it was supposed to be. We were supposed to be in recession for Germany. And now we've got the Scholz, the Chancellor last week, saying no recession for Germany. We've got the governors of the Bank of France, the governors of the Bank of Italy saying, yeah, you know, our outlooks are improving. You look at the performance of European stocks this year relative to US, so that the market has been buying into this far better than expected story for Europe. And we've got euro dollar, you know, touching this week at 109. I think the big question is how much of that is priced in and how much further can the euro sort of dine out on that story? Because, you know, it looked this week at the PMIs. The PMIs were like, oh, you know, they're not really that good. There are still headwinds coming. And as we move into the certainly into the summer and the autumn, we could have another phase of the energy crisis. We don't know how cold next winter is going to be. So there are still headwinds facing the euro, and the market now is quite long of the euro. So don't think it's going to be that easy to push up to another leg. But of course, a crucial element of this is the dollar, and will the market continue to disbelieve the Fed guidance about the interest rate outlook for this year?
So I've asked this question three times this week. Maybe you've heard me ask it. Let's make it four. Who hikes more this year, the Fed or the ECB?
I have heard you ask that, and I have heard the answers, and I think you know what I'm going to say too, because it's the same as everybody else. You know, the ECB is likely to hike more, but the question really is that in the price now or not?
It's four for four, but that's an important question, that's for sure. Jane Farley of Rabobank, fantastic to catch up with you here in London.
Let's get to it. If you're in Global Wall Street, this is without question your interview of the day. If you need to be optimistic, there's no better place to be than at Deutsche Bank with their chief global strategist and head of asset allocation, Vikram Chadha. Mr. Chadha has made clear he is enthusiastic, and as it hasn't happened, he's simply moved his timeline out. We get an update this morning from Binky Chadha. Binky, you're at 4,500, 4,400, 4,600. Nobody believes you. You've never been this lonely in your storied career. Give us the x-axis. When's the timeline when Chadha Nirvana happens?
So actually what we have in terms of our outlook for this year is really the rally in Q1, which we think of as basically a continuation of the rally that began late last year. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as, sort of a bullish view on fundamentals. The basic driver of the rally, in our view, is really a positioning squeeze. As we know, since late April of last year, it's all really been about the central banks. And if you look at our measures of positioning, the fundamental investors, we call them the discretionary equity investors, you know, very quickly moved down to neutral to slightly negative. What got squeezed as a result of the last 6 months of last year is really systematic strategies. Systematic strategies tend to follow the market. So to have this big divide between systematic strategies, you know, two Z scores below neutral, let alone where they most of the time.
I flunked that on the CFA exam. Binky, let me cut to the chase. Ralph Ankomporan, technical analysis, is adamant we made an October low in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. He's as bullish as you are. Mm-hmm. So there's a short squeeze. We're squeezing out the gloom. I get that.
Yeah.
What's the then what after we squeeze out the gloom for you and Mr. Ankomporan?
So, you know, we have our year-end target, which, yes, I understand it looks bullish. I would say it's only a little bit more than 10% up from where we've been recently. We see most of that happening basically in Q1. And then we have basically, as you know, a call for a recession in the U.S. Starting in Q3. So second quarter, keeping in line with the recession playbook historically, we have the market going sideways. So that's still 4,500. We have, if the recession happens in Q3, a pretty severe sell-off, which would take us all the way down to 3,250. But I think, you know, very important aspect of the recession playbook to keep in mind if you're thinking out 12 months is that equities, you know, pretty robustly bottom about halfway through. So if you have a two-quarter recession, they will come all the way back basically in Q4. And so my Q1 target is my year-end target. Yeah.
You said something pretty radical, that it's all been about the Fed. it is not necessarily about some of these other issues like earnings, which we keep getting and a lot of people keep looking at.
Sure.
So how do you push back against that? And how much do you expect tech to continue to lead, regardless of the up or the down, because of that macro play?
Yeah. So it tactically, our call is to be, you know, the rally will be led by tech and the financials and some of the consumer cyclicals where, you know, priced in 120% of an average recession. I think it starts to make things pretty asymmetric. I'm sorry, I lost the last part of the question.
No, but this is an issue because right now
I
we're looking
to. I do the same thing. Don't say you're sorry.
What, no. Just because of me? No, this is an issue, interesting issue because right now I'm watching earnings and people are saying there's a real fundamental shift underneath the market, that you have tech that's not necessarily going to lead in growth, even though they now are leading in returns just simply because of cuts, et cetera. And I'm wondering whether you see that, whether we're heading back to a different normal in terms of leadership or whether we're heading back to the same regime. It's just sort of dependent on the Fed.
So, you know, in terms of earnings, for the year as a whole, you know, if you put in a recession in there like we have, you know, we're talking about $195. So the question is, you know, what happens if the alternative, which is a very popular question given the market price action, and it's more likely to go sideways and even to start to recover. I think in terms of thinking about earnings, you know, everybody talks always about growth rates. I think it's also important to keep in mind where the levels are. You know, equity valuations come off of levels. And earnings have been running, you know, sort of well above trend levels. So, you know, we have this issue where, yeah. I mean, even if you looked at real activity, you know, the good side of the economy, it's essentially been going sideways for two years now. You know,
we're out of time, Binky, at 4,500 on SPX. And what Mr. Chadha just said there, Lisa, is religion to me, which is that financial TV is addicted to change, movement, stay with us, Microsoft right now down under 236, that kind of stuff. He's looking at levels. And this is the bathtub story. You're looking at the water coming in and out of the bathtub, or you're looking at the level. Olivier Blanchard in his new monograph is on the same page in economics as Vikram Chadha in equities. Levels matter.
Levels matter.
The levels, the scale, the mass of Microsoft matters.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
William McDonough is founder. He's chief executive officer. They've got a bunch of other titles for him at Element Funds. What he is one of the wisest people across a span of this thing called wealth management, is managing money and really, really trying hard to do the hardest thing, which is not lose money. We are thrilled that William McDonough can join us today. It's wrapped around Tesla. It's wrapped around what Mr. Musk is doing in these historic Muskian times. But there's about eight other things to talk about as well. Will, thank you for joining us. You really center in your research note that the Tesla cars are a Trojan horse. Many people agree with you on that. What is Mr. Musk really up to?
Well, you know, let's look back to 2006 when Musk really kicked this thing off, and his kind of opening mandate for the company was build a sports car, use the money to build an affordable car, use the money to build a more affordable car, and provide zero emissions power generations options to the world. He's following that. We need to listen to what he said. And I think what we're going to see from Tesla when they report today, we might not see Musk. I think they're starting to realize that maybe he isn't the optimal person to do the SEC communications, much like Apple did with Steve Jobs back in the day. Let's throw a black turtleneck on this guy. Let's put him on stage. Let's talk about the Cybertruck. Let's stop all these communications with regulators. That ain't his highest and best use.
I love that view of Tim Cook. Basically, how much can you put him into the background?
That's not a grab down and coddle. Continue.
Will, when you say a Trojan horse for the EV, for the battery, is this a positive for the stock or a negative when you look at its longer term market share and potential?
Well, you know, I was interested in what Julian just said, and I think there's a broader war on Wall Street right now and a juxtaposition between the top line and the bottom line. Like, what are we being judged by these days? We just came out of an environment where it was growth, growth, growth at all costs. I don't care what it costs to acquire a user, get the user. And then the tide went out and we saw that that probably wasn't the right way to approach it. And now people are repositioning their thoughts around, well, what's the bottom line? What's the revenue? What's the EBITDA? And when you look at a company like Tesla, you know, there's no justification for it being a $1.2 trillion company. We have our perspectives on why that happened, which I'll share. But when you really look at their numbers, you know, they have less revenue than GM, than Ford, than Volkswagen, than BMW. But they have eight times the market cap of Ford and GM. So what are we really doing here? What are we really looking at? We think investors play Tesla as a vehicle to get exposure to EV adoption. But what our business charge, our ticker on the New York Stock Exchange, allows people to do is just buy the base metals that are required for all EV, all solar, and all wind.
Well, but Will, then what are you looking for in today's Tesla earnings? Because it sounds like you've got a very strong belief. There are a lot of questions people are going to be asking about the discounts that recently Elon Musk and Tesla instated in some of the vehicles. What are you looking for to inform how much you amp up your view?
Yeah, I think that they're going to put their toe in the water a bit today. I don't believe that they're going to come heavy. You know, they have announced that in March they're going to do their first investor day and they're going to brand that. There has been talks that they're going to launch their own investor platform that's going to allow for them to engage directly with their investors, much like you've seen Musk do with Twitter, polling, do you think I should be CEO or not? I think you're going to see more engagement directly with the investors. The investors feel like they're doing what they want to do. But if I'm Tesla and I'm on the board of Tesla, as I alluded to, I'm putting him back in his corner and saying, go stand next to the semi truck and let us report the numbers. And then let's do the fancy stuff and the exciting stuff in March.
Well, I got eight ways to go here. And to get you on here on Tesla and Musk is interesting. I want to go to your experience, not only with Bob Diamond. We thank Bob Diamond so much for coming on recently on the death of Scott Minard. But I want to talk to you, Will, about your stance in Florida and your management of people's money, celebrity management and that, in this thing called crypto. The Bitcoin losses have been taken, but far more the upset of crypto right now, which is tarred and feathered, I believe, one of your clients over the years, Mr. Brady, who throws footballs in Tampa. Tell me about the McDonough view on crypto.
Well, I think what happened in crypto in the last kind of 100 days is net positive for the industry because it flushed out a lot of the centralized players. It flushed out a lot of the unregulated players, which crypto needs to have a barbell approach to success. It needs to have pure decentralization that allows people globally to interact with it in a fair way. And then it also needs to have a heavily regulated on-ramp that allows investors and allows scale to come into the space and trust who their counterparties are. And I think if both of those things are accomplished, blockchain has no end.
How does the United States use a regulatory reach internationally given the criminal allegations within crypto?
The U.S. is the on-ramp for all global financial systems, right? I mean, let's just admit it. The volumes that come in through the U.S. markets, the volumes that trade on the U.S. exchanges, this is where the money comes from. Even if it isn't sourced here, it's managed here. And so This is the on-ramp to crypto. That's how they can control it, is by saying, we control how you get money into the system and out of the system. And then the good thing about these blockchains is that they're very easily auditable. And so once you're on that system and we know who you were coming in, I can track what you do while you're in there.
Right.
And then I can see you come back out.
But do you have, with your immense, you know, international perspective here, your work at Goldman Sachs over the years, et cetera, William, I'm absolutely fascinated how a guy like you feels Department of Justice or SEC can fix the international regulation conundrum of crypto. How do you envision them moving forward?
I think they need to do it just like they've done any other industry over the last 100 years. You got to punch it right in the face, and you got to address it and embrace it and really get to know it and understand it. You know, some of the times they've come out with statements have just shown that they actually truly don't understand the underlying.
Right.
When I believe that the majority of the real players in crypto embrace that regulation because they know that that will open up those floodgates for that institutional capital. And so they just need to really get people around the table that know what they're talking about and put some regulation in place. That brings comfort.
To be clear here, Will, Bitcoin 15 to 23,000, are you considering it's appropriate in a portfolio today?
I always do. You know, I think Bitcoin's trading at year end was somewhat driven around the fact that people tax loss harvest into the new year and they realize that they can put a little bit away. People don't realize that Bitcoin isn't subject to wash rules. So there's a lot of trading like that that occurs. And then you've seen a lot of people leaning in here in Q1 because the FTX stuff and a lot of bad stuff flushed out in Q4, I'm not sure how much bad news can continue to come.
Well, thank you so much. Very candid there. William McDonough with us from Element Funds today. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.